Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press.
Something Special by Iris Murdoch. "Why wouldn't you take him now?" said Mrs. Geary. She was setting the evening papers to rights on the counter. Yvonne sat astride a chair in the middle of the shop. She had it tilting precariously and was rubbing her small head animal fashion on the wood of the back, while her long legs were braced to prevent herself from toppling over. In answer to the question, she said nothing. "She's cross again," said her uncle, who was standing at the door of the inner room. "Who's she?" "She's the cat," said Yvonne. She began to rock the chair violently to and fro. "Don't be breaking down that chair," said her mother. "It's the last we have of the decent ones till the cane man is back. Why wouldn't you take him, is what I asked." Close outside the shop, the tram for Dublin came rattling by, darkening the scene for a moment and making little objects on the higher shelves jump and tinkle. It was a hot evening, and the door stood wide open to the dust of the street. "Oh, leave off," said Yvonne. "I don't want him. I don't want to marry. He's nothing special." "Nothing special, is it?" said her uncle. "He's a nice young man and a steady job, and he wants to wed you, and you no longer so young. Or would you be living all your life on your ma?" "If you won't wed him, you shouldn't be leading him up the garden," said her mother, "and leave breaking that chair." "Can't I be ordinary friends with a boy," said Yvonne, "without the pair of you being at me? I'm 24, and I know what I'm about." "You're 24 indeed," said her mother. "And there's Betty Nolan and Maureen Burke are married these 3 years, and they in a lower form than you at school." "I'm not the like of those two," said Yvonne. "True for you," said her mother. "It's a women's magazine," said her uncle, "and the little novels she's forever reading that are putting ideas in her head until she won't marry except it's the Sheikh of Araby. It's little enough she finds to do with her time," said her mother, "so that she's always in there in the dark little room, flat on her tum with her nose inside a novel, till it's a wonder her two eyes aren't worn away in her head." "Can't I live my life as I please," said Yvonne, "since it's the only thing I have? It's that I can't see him as something special, and I won't marry him if I can't." "He's one of the chosen people," said her uncle. "Isn't that special enough?" "Don't start on that thing again," said her mother. "Sam's a nice young fellow, and not like the run of the Jew boys at all. He'd bring the children up Church of Ireland." "At that," said her uncle, "it's better than the other lot, with the little priest after them the whole time and bobbing their heads at the chapel doors, so you can't even have a peaceful ride on the tram. I've nothing against the Jews." "Our Lord was a Jew," said Yvonne. "Don't be saying bold things like that," said her mother. "Our Lord was the Son of God," said her uncle, "and that's neither Jew nor Greek." "Is it this evening the Christmas card man is coming?" said Yvonne. "It is," said her mother, "though why they want to be bothering us with Christmas cards in the middle of summer, I'm at a loss to know." "I'll wait by and see him," said Yvonne. "You always pick the dull ones." "I pick the ones that sell," said her mother, "and don't you be after hanging around acting the maggot when Sam comes. There's little enough room in there." "If you were married, at least you'd be out of this," said her uncle, "and it isn't your ma you'd be sharing a bed with then, and you're always complaining about the pokey hole this place is." "It is a pokey hole," said Yvonne, "but then I'd be in another pokey hole some other place." "I'm tired telling you," said her mother. "You could get one of those new little houses off the Drumcondra Road. The man in McMullen's shop knows the man that keeps the list." "I don't want a new little house," said Yvonne. "I tell you, I don't see him right, and that's that." "If you wait till you marry for love," said her uncle, "you'll wait 10 years and then make a foolish match. You're not Greta Garbo, and you're lucky there's a young fellow after you at all. Sensible people marry because they want to be in the married state, and not because of feeling they have in their breasts." "She's still stuck on the English lad," said her mother, "the tall fellow. Tony Thingummy was his name." "I am not," said Yvonne. "Good riddance to bad rubbish." "I could not abide his voice," said her uncle. "He had his mouth all prissed up when he talked, like a man was acting in a play." "Isn't it the like of the bloody English to win the sweep again this year?" said her mother. "He brought me flowers," said Yvonne. Flowers, is it? Said her uncle. And singing little songs to you, you said once. He was a jaunty boy, said her mother, and a fine slim thing with some pretty ways to him, but he's gone now. And you wait until you see what Sam will bring you one of these days. Ah, you're potty with that diamond ring story, said her uncle. You'll turn the child's head on her. That fellow's as poor as we are. There's nobody as poor as we are, said Yvonne. He's a hired man, said her uncle. I don't deny he may get to have his own tailoring shop one day and be his own master. I can see that in him, that he's not a Jew for nothing, but he's no fancy worker now, and he's poorly off. Those ones are never poor, said her mother. They just pretend to be, so their own people won't be taking their bits of money off them. It's near his time to come, said Yvonne. Don't be talking about him when he comes in. It's not manners. Listen who's mentioning manners, said her uncle. You recall the time, said her mother. We met him at poor Mr. Stacy's sale, and we went to Sullivan's bar after, and he paid for two rounds. He was for catching Yvonne's eye, said her uncle, with flashing his wad around. I'll lay he had to walk home. You're a fine one, said her mother, and you telling me to encourage the child. Did I ever say she should marry him for his money, said her uncle. Well, you'll see, said her mother. It's the custom of those ones. When they want to be engaged to a girl, they suddenly bring the diamond ring out, and the girl says yes. If they do, it's on hire from the pop shop, said her uncle, and it's back in the window directly. What's Julia Beatty's ring, then, said her mother, and what's her name, young Polly's sister, who married Jews, the pair of them, and it happened that way with both. One evening, quite suddenly, I want to show you something, says he, and there was the ring, and they were engaged from then. I tell you, it's a custom. Well, I hope you're right, I'm sure, said her uncle. It might be just the thing that would make up the grand young lady's mind. A diamond ring, now, that would be something special, wouldn't it? A diamond ring, said Yvonne, would be a change, at least. Perhaps he'll have it with him this very night, said her mother. I don't think, said Yvonne. Where are you off to, anyway, said her mother. I haven't the faintest, said Yvonne. Into town, I suppose. You might go down the pier, said her uncle, and see the mail boat out. That would be better for you than sitting in those stuffy bars or walking along the Liffey, breathing the foul airs of the river and coming home smelling of Guinness. Besides, you know Sam likes the sea, said her mother. He's been all day long dying of suffocation in that steamy room with the clothes press. It's more fun in town, said Yvonne. They've got the decorations up for Ireland at home, and I've been all day long dying of boredom in Kingstown. It's well for you, said her uncle, that it's Sam that pays. And I don't like your going into those low places, said her mother. That's not Sam's idea, I know. It's you. Sam's not one for sitting dreaming in a bar. That's another thing I like about him. Kimball's have a new saloon lounge, said Yvonne, like a real drawing room done up with flowers and those crystal lights. Maybe we'll go there. You'll pay extra, said her uncle. Let Sam worry about that, said her mother. It's a relief they have those saloon lounges in the pubs nowadays where you can get away from the smell of porter and a lady can sit there without being taken for something else. Here's a Christmas card, man, said Yvonne and jumped up from her chair. Why, Mr. Lynch, said Mrs. Geary, it's a pleasure to see you again. Who'd think a whole year had gone by? It seems like yesterday you were here before. Good evening, Mrs. Geary, said Mr. Lynch. It's a blessing to see you looking so well, and Miss Geary and Mr. O'Brien still with you. Change and decay in all around we see. I'm told poor Mrs. Taylor at the place in Monkstown has passed on since now a year ago. Yes, the poor old faggot, said Mrs. Geary, but after 70 years you can't complain, can you? The good Lord's lending it to you after that. Our time is always on loan, Mrs. Geary, said Mr. Lynch, and who knows when the great creditor will call. We are as grass which today flourisheth, and tomorrow it is cast into the oven. We'll go through, said Mrs. Geary, and Mr. O'Brien will mind the shop. Yvonne and her mother went into the inner room, followed by Mr. Lynch. The inner room was very dark, lit only on the far side by a window of frosted glass that gave onto the kitchen. It had a bedroom smell of ancient fabrics and perspiration and dust. Mrs. Geary turned on the light. The mountainous double bed, with its great white quilt and brass knobs and rails, wherein she and her daughter slept, took up half the room. A shiny horsehair sofa took up most of the other half, leaving space for a small velvet-topped table and three black chairs which stood in a row in front of the towering mantel shelf, where photographs and brass animals rose in tiers to the ceiling. Mr. Lynch opened his suitcase and began to spread out the Christmas cards on the faded red velvet. "The robin and the snow go well," said Mrs. Geary, "and the stagecoach is popular and the church lit up at night." "The traditional themes of Christmastide," said Mr. Lynch, "have a universal appeal." "Oh, look," said Yvonne, "that's the nicest one I've ever seen. Now that's really special." She held it aloft. A frame of glossy golden cardboard enclosed a little square of white silk on which some roses were embroidered. "That's a novelty," said Mr. Lynch, "and comes a bit more expensive." "It's not like a true Christmas card, the fancy thing," said Mrs. Geary. "I always think a nice picture and a nice verse is what you want. The sentiment is all." "Here's Sam," said Mr. O'Brien from the shop. Sam came and stood in the doorway from the shop, frowning in the electric light. He was a short man. Portly, Mr. O'Brien called him, and he could hardly count as handsome. He had a pale moon face and fugitive hands, but his eyes were dark, and his dark bushy head of hair was like the brave plume of a bird. He had his best suit on, which was a midnight blue with a gray stripe, and his tie was of light yellow silk. "Come on in, Sam," said Mrs. Geary. "Yvonne's been ready this long time. Mr. Lynch, this is Mr. Goldman." "How do you do?" they said. "You are mighty smart tonight, Sam," said Mrs. Geary. "Going to have a special evening?" "We're choosing the Christmas card," said Yvonne. "Have you got any with the ox and the ass on, Mr. Lynch?" "Here," said Mr. Lynch, "we have the ox and the ass, and here we see our Lord lying in the manger and his mother by, and here the three magi with their costly gifts, and here the angels coming to the poor shepherds by night, and here the star of glory that led them on. When Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king." "I still like this one best," said Yvonne. "Look, Sam, isn't that pretty?" She held up the card with the golden frame. "You two be off now," said Mrs. Geary, "and leave troubling Sam with these Christian things." "I don't mind," said Sam. "I always observe Christmas just as you do, Mrs. Geary. I take it as a sort of emblem." "That's right," said Mr. Lynch. "What, after all, divides us one from another? In my father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you." "I'll just get my coat," said Yvonne. "Don't keep her out late, Sam," said Mrs. Geary. "Goodbye now, and mind you have a really nice evening." "Abyssinia," said Yvonne. They left the cool, musty air of the shop and emerged into the big, warm, perfumed summer dusk. Yvonne threw her head back and pranced along in her high-heeled shoes, wearing the look of petulant intensity which she always affected for the benefit of Sam. She would not take his arm, and they went a little aimlessly down the street. "Where shall we go?" said Sam. "I don't mind," she said. "We might walk a bit by the sea," said Sam, "and sit on the rocks beyond the baths. It's too windy down there, and I can't go on the rocks in these shoes. Well, let's go into town." At that moment, from the seaward side came a sonorous booming sound, very deep and sad. It came again, was sustained in a melancholy roar, and died slowly away. "Ah, the mailboat," said Sam. "Let's just see it out. It's ages since I saw it out." They walked briskly as far as the Mariner's Church and turned along the front into the racing breeze. In the evening light, the scene before them glowed like a colored postcard. The mailboat had its lights on already, making pale, shifting reflections in the water, which was still glossy with daylight. As they came nearer, the boat began to move very slowly and drew away from the big brown wooden quay, revealing upon it the rows and rows of people left behind, agitating their white handkerchiefs in the darkening air. The scene was utterly silent. A curly plume of black smoke gathered upon the metallic water, hid the ship for a moment, and then lifted to show it gliding away between the two lighthouses, whose beams were kindled at that very time, and into the open sea. Beyond it a large pale moon was rising over Howthead. "The moon hath raised her lamp above," said Sam. "I've seen the mailboat out 100 times, said Yvonne, "and one day I'll be on it." "Would you like to go to England, then?" said Sam. Yvonne gave him a look of exaggerated scorn. "Doesn't every Irish person with a soul in them want to go to England?" she said. They walked more slowly back now, past the golden windows of Ross's Hotel to take the Dublin tram. By the time they had climbed the hill, the ship was halfway across the horizon. its trail of smoke taken up into the gathering night, and by the time they got off the tram at Nelson's Pillar, the daylight was gone entirely. "Now where would you like to go?" said Sam. "Don't be eternally asking me that question," she said. "Just go somewhere yourself, and I'll probably follow." Sam took her arm, which she let him hold this time, and walked her back toward O'Connell Bridge and along onto the quays. The Liffey flowed past them, oily and glistening, as black as Guinness, bound for Dublin Bay. It had not far to go now. Along the parapet at intervals and hanging suspended from the iron tracery of the street lamps were metal baskets full of flowers, while a banner hanging on the bridge announced in English and in Irish that Ireland was at home to visitors. There was a mingled smell of garbage and pollen. Sam turned her toward the river and was for lingering there in a sentimental way, his arm creeping about her waist. The moon was risen now over the top of the houses. But Yvonne said firmly, "You'll get your death with the smell of the drains here. Let's go to Kimball's place and try the new saloon lounge." They turned up the side street that led to Kimball's. It was a dirty, dark little street, but a blaze of light and a good deal of hubbub at the far end of it declared the whereabouts of that hostelry. The ordinary bar, which had formerly been the only one, was in the basement, while on the street level was Kimball's grocery store, and above this the saloon lounge before mentioned. From the well of the stairs below came an odor of men and drink and the tinkling of a piano and an uproar of male voices. Sam and Yvonne turned aside and mounted a brightly lit carpeted stairway, which smelt strongly of new paint, and emerged into the lounge. The door shut itself quietly behind them. Here everything was still. Yvonne walked across the heavy carpet and sat down on a fat chintz sofa and arranged her dress. In the gilded mirror behind the bar, she could see the reflection of Sam's face as he ordered a gin and lime for her and a draft Guinness for himself. For an instant, she concentrated the glow of her imagination upon him, but could only notice that he leaned forward in an apologetic way to the barman, and how absurdly his small feet turned out as he stood there. He gave the order in a low voice, as if he were asking for something not quite nice at the chemist's. A few couples sat scattered about the room, huddled under the shared lights, murmuring to each other. When Sam came back with the drinks, Yvonne said loudly, "You'd think you were in a church here, not in a public house." "Shh," said Sam. One or two people stared. Sam sat down close beside her on the sofa, trying to make himself drink. He edged nearer still, but curling into himself like a hedgehog so as to be as near as possible without giving offense. He put down his glass on the table and began laboriously in his mind the long search for words, for the simple words that would lead on to the more important ones. His pale, stumpy hand caressed Yvonne's bony, brown hand. Hers lay there listlessly in a way that was familiar to him. He squeezed it a little and tried to draw her back towards him, deeper into the sofa. So they sat there a while in silence, Sam searching and holding and Yvonne stiff. The upholstered stillness around them was not good for their talk. The barman chinked a glass and everyone in the room jumped. "This place gives me heart disease," said Yvonne. "It's a lot like dead people giving a party. Let's go and see what it's like downstairs. I've never been downstairs here." "It's not nice," said Sam. "Ladies don't go downstairs. Why not let's go back to Henry Street? There's the little coffee bar you liked once." "That was a silly place," said Yvonne. "I'm going downstairs anyway. You can do as you like." She said this in a loud voice and then got up and walked firmly toward the door. Sam, red with embarrassment, jumped up too, took a hasty pull at his drink, and followed her out. They descended into the street and took the iron staircase that led to the basement. The noise and the smell were stronger than before. Yvonne hesitated halfway down. "You'd better lead," she said. Sam stumbled past her and pushed at the blackened door of the bar. He had never been down those stairs either. They came out into a very big, low-roofed room with white-tiled walls and blazing, unshaded lights. The floor was slimy with spilt drink and beery sawdust, and the atmosphere was thick. The pounding, repetitive beat of a piano, its melody absorbed into the continuous din of voices, was felt rather than heard. A great many men who were adhering to a circular bar in the center turned to stare at Yvonne as she entered. It looked at first as if no women were present, but as the haze shifted here and there, it was possible to discern one or two lurking in the darkened alcoves. There are women here, called Yvonne triumphantly. Not nice ones, said Sam. What's your drink? He hated being looked at. Whiskey, said Yvonne. She refused to sit down, but stood there, swaying slightly and holding on to one of the ironwork pillars that circled the bar. The men nearby studied her with insolent appreciation and made remarks. She colored a little, but stared straight in front of her, bright-eyed. It was not easy for poor Sam to get at the bar. The clients who were standing in his way were in no hurry to move, though they looked at him amiably enough. The bartender, an infernal version of his upstairs colleague, pointedly served two later-comers first, and then with ironic politeness handed Sam the drinks. "Isn't this better than up there?" Yvonne shouted, seizing her glass from him as he got back to her side. "That's the stuff'll put the red neck on you," observed a man with a penetrating voice who was standing close to Yvonne. "Your mother's something or other," Sam shouted back, propelling Yvonne fussily into a space in the middle of the floor where he stood holding tightly onto her arm. She stopped trying to hear his voice and gave herself up to the pleasure of being part of such a noisy, crowded, drunken scene. By the time she had sipped the half of her whiskey, she was perceptibly enjoying herself very much indeed. Upon the confused flood of noise and movement, she was now afloat. After a short while, there was something quite particular to watch, a little scene which seemed to be developing on the near side of the bar. Someone was waving his arms and shouting in an angry voice, whereon the publican, in even higher tones, was heard to cry, "Just raise your hand again, mister, and you're out in the street. Patsy, put that gentleman out in the street." People crowded quickly forward from the alcoves to see the fun. The piano stopped abruptly, and the sound of voices became suddenly jagged and harsh. A woman with a red carnation in her hair and an overwhelming perfume came and stood beside Yvonne, her bare arm touching the girl's sleeve. Yvonne could see at once that she was not a nice sort of woman at all, and she removed herself from the contact. The woman gave her a provoking stare. "Time for us to make tracks," said Sam to Yvonne. "Ah, shut up," she said, looking past him with glowing eyes to where the drama was unfolding. A tall, thin young fellow, the prey designate of Patsy, was swaying to and fro, still flourishing his fist and trying to make a statement, intended, no doubt, as an insult or vindication, but whose complexity was such that he began it several times over without succeeding in making himself clear. His antagonist, a thick man with a Cork accent, who accompanied these attempts with a continual sneering noise, suddenly gave him a violent jab in the stomach. The young man oscillated and lurched back amid laughter with a look of extreme surprise. To keep his balance, he twisted dexterously about on his heel and found himself face to face with Yvonne. "Ah," said the young man. He stood there poised, frozen in the gesture of turning, with one hand outstretched ballet-wise, and slowly allowed a look of imbecile delight to transfigure his features. Another laugh went up. "Ah," said the young man, "I thought the flowers were all falling, but here is a rose in the bud." He seemed to have found his tongue. The woman with the red carnation clapped Yvonne on the shoulder. "Come along, the little pet," she cried, "and give the kind gentleman a good answer." The thin young man turned upon her. "You leave the young lady alone," he shouted. "She isn't your like." And with that he darted out his hand and plucked the red carnation from the woman's hair and thrust it with another lurch into the bosom of Yvonne's frock. There was a roar of applause. Yvonne sprang away. The woman turned quick as a flash and slapped the young man in the face. But quicker still, the woman's escort, a brown man with an arm like an ape, had snatched the flower back from where it hung at Yvonne's breast and given her a push which sent her flying back against the wall. There was a momentary delighted silence. People by now had climbed on chairs to get a better view, and tiers of grinning, unshaven faces peered down through the haze. Yvonne was crimson. For a moment she leaned there rigid, as if pinned to the tiles. Then Sam had taken her by the hand and was leading her quickly out of the bar. Before the heavy doors were shut again, they heard the yell which followed them up to the street. "It's safer upstairs, mister," screamed a woman's voice. When Yvonne got out onto the pavement, she wrenched her hand away from Sam and began to run. She ran like a hare down the dark and ill-smelling street toward the open lamplight of the quays, and here Sam caught her up, leaning against the parapet of the river and drooping her head down and panting. "Oh, my dear darling, didn't—" Sam began to say, but he was interrupted. Out of the hazy darkness beyond the street lamps, a third figure had emerged. It was the thin young man, also at a run. He gripped Sam by the arm. "No offense, mister," said the young man. "No offense. It was a tribute, a sincere tribute, from one of Ireland's poets. A true poet, mister." He stood there, still holding on to Sam with one hand and staring wide-eyed at Yvonne, while the other hand fumbled in his coat pocket. "That's all right," said Sam. "It wasn't your fault, surely. We've just got to go now." He began gently but vigorously to detach the clutching fingers from his arm. The young man held on tight. "If I could only find me bloody poem," he said, "a sincere tribute, a humble and sincere tribute to one of the wonders of nature. A beautiful woman is one of the wonders of nature, a flower." "Yes, yes, all right," said Sam. "We don't mind. We've just got to go now to get our tram." "Fitting homage," said the young man. "Sweets to the sweet." He let go abruptly of Sam and struck a graceful attitude. The post proving too difficult to maintain, he heeled over slowly against the edge of the quay and came into violent contact with one of the metal flower baskets. "Did I mention flowers?" he cried. "And here they are. Flowers for her, for a gift, for a tribute." He plunged his fingers into the basket and brought out a handful of geraniums together with a great quantity of earth, all of which fell to the ground in a heap, partly engulfing Yvonne's shoes. "Come on," said Sam. But Yvonne had already turned and was walking away very fast, swinging her arms and shaking her feet as she walked in order to get some of the earth out. Sam followed quickly after her, and the young man followed after Sam, still talking. "What is her name?" he was crying in an aggrieved tone. "What is her name, who makes rose petals rain from heaven, and with, oh, such eyes and lips? This was something that I spoke about in a poem." And as they walked on, the three of them, in Indian file and with quickening pace in the direction of O'Connell Street, the young man plucked the flowers from the baskets and drew their stems through his fingers to gather tight handfuls of petals, which he cast high over Sam's head so that they should rain down upon Yvonne. "Now then, young fellow," said the policeman, who suddenly materialized as the little procession neared O'Connell Bridge. "Let me remind you, it's public money is spent on those flowers you are defiling in a way renders you liable for prosecution." "Nature intended," the young man began. "That may well be," said the policeman, "and I intend to have you up for willful and malicious damages." The two figures converged. Sam and Yvonne drew away. As they were passing Hannah's bookshop, Sam caught up with her. Her face was stony. He began to ask her, was she all right? At first she would say nothing, but turned savagely away over the bridge in the direction of Westmoreland Street. Then she cried in a weary voice, "Oh, be silent! I've enough of this. Just come to the tram." Sam raised his hands and then spread them out, opening the palms. For a while he trotted behind her in silence, his plume of black hair bobbing over his eyes. "Yvonne," he said then, "don't go away yet. Let me just make you forget those things. You'll never pardon me if you go away with those things between us." Yvonne slowed her step and looked around at him sullenly. "It isn't that anything matters," she said, "or that I'm surprised at all. It's that I thought it might be a specially nice evening. More fool me, and that's all." Sam's hands clasped themselves in front of him and then spread wide once more. He made her stop now and face him. They were well up the street. "It can be still," he said urgently, "a special evening. Don't spoil it now by being cross. Wait a bit. It's not the last tram yet." Yvonne hesitated and let Sam pull her limp arm through his. "But where can we put ourselves at this hour?" "Never you mind," said Sam with a sudden confidence. "You come along with me, and if you're a good girl, there's something special I've got to show you." "Something to show me?" said Yvonne. She let him lead her along in the direction of Grafton Street. As he turned the corner, Sam boldly locked his fingers through hers and kneaded her thin hand in the palm of his own. She welcomed him with a very little pressure, so they walked the length of the street, linked in a precarious and conscious hold. The dark mass of Stephen's Green was appearing now in front of them, and they crossed the road towards it. A few people were gathered still in the golden glow outside the Shelburne, but on the farther side of the square there was no one. Sam began to draw her along, slinking close beside the railings. I'm destroyed walking in these shoes, said Yvonne. Where is the place you're going to?
Here it is, said Sam. He stopped and pointed suddenly to a gap in the railings. There's a rail out, and we can go through inside the garden.
It's not allowed, said Yvonne. It's shut to the public now.
We're not the public, you and me, said Sam. He put his feet boldly through the hole and ducked to the other side. Then, with authority, he pulled the girl in after him. She gave a little cry, finding herself in a tangle of damp undergrowth.
It's horrid in here. My stockings are tearing.
Give me your hands back, said Sam. He took both her hands and half lifted her out onto a dark lawn of grass. She took a few steps across its moist, spongy surface and then felt the hard grit of the path underneath her feet. They emerged into bright moonlight beside the water. The big moon looked up at them from the lake, clear-cut and almost full, intensely bright.
Oh, dear, said Yvonne, silenced for a moment by the ghostly radiance. They stood hand in hand looking into the black mirror of the lake, their long moon shadows stretched out behind them. Yvonne began to peer nervously about her.
Sam, she said in a whisper, I don't like this being here. Someone'll find us. Please let us go back.
I won't hurt you, said Sam, whispering too in a caressing, exultant, tender whisper. I'll look after you. I'll always look after you. I just wanted to show you something nice.
Well, said Yvonne. She followed him a few steps as he moved and looked up into his face.
Here it is, said Sam.
Where?
Here, look.
He reached his hand towards a dark shape.
Yvonne recoiled from him violently. What seemed a monster was there in the darkness. Then she made out that there was a fallen tree lying right across the path beside the lake, its topmost branches just touching the water.
What is it? She said with revulsion.
A fallen tree, said Sam. I don't know what kind.
Yvonne looked at him. She saw his two eyes gleam almost cat-like in the darkness in the light of the reflected moon, but they were not looking at her.
But you were going to show me something.
Yes, this, the poor tree.
Yvonne was dumb for a moment. Then she came choking into speech.
This was it, then, you stopped me from the tram for and made me walk a mile for and tear my stockings. Just a dirty, rotten, maggoty old tree.
Her voice rose higher and she hit out wildly with her hand, whipping a flurry of foliage across Sam's round, moonlit face.
But no, said Sam, quite calmly now beside her. Only see it, Yvonne. Be quiet for a minute and see it. It's so beautiful, though indeed it's a sad thing for a tree to lie like this, all fresh with its green leaves on the ground, like a flower that's been picked.
I know it's a sad thing, but come to me now and we'll be a pair of birds up in the branches.
He took her against her will and drew her to him among the rustling leaves which lay in a tall fan across the path. He kissed the girl very gently on the cheek.
Yvonne got free of his grasp and stumbled back, beating away the leafy twigs from her neck.
"Was this all?" she said with violence. "Was this all that you wanted me to see? It's nothing, and I hate it. I hate your beastly tree and its dirt and the worms and beetles falling down inside my dress." She began to cry.
Sam came out of the leaves and stood ruefully beside her, trying to get hold of her hand.
"I only wanted to please you," he said. "It's a sad thing to show you, I know, and not very exciting, but I thought it was beautiful, and—"
"I hate it," said Yvonne, and began to run away from him across the grass, blubbering as she ran. She was before him at the hole in the railings, and he had to run after her as she hurried along the pavement, trailing a sort of bramble behind her from her skirt. Now Sam's confidence was all gone.
"Yvonne," he called. "Don't be holding it against me, Yvonne. I didn't mean—"
"Oh, shut up," said Yvonne.
"Don't be holding it against me."
"Oh, stop whining," she said. The tram for Dunlowhere came lurching into sight as Sam still followed after Yvonne, pawing at her arm and asking her to forgive him. Yvonne got onto the tram and, without looking back at him, climbed the stairs quickly to the top. Sam stood still on the pavement and was left behind, his two hands raised in the air in a gesture of dereliction. Once upon the tram, Yvonne shed no more tears. When she got back to Upper George's Street, she fumbled in her bag for the latch key, which she had not had for long, and let herself into the shop. It was very still in the shop. The familiar smell of wood and old paper made itself quietly known.
Behind her, the last cars and trams were rumbling by, and in the dark space in front of her was to be heard the heavy breathing of her mother, already sleeping in the inner room. But in the shop it was very silent, and all the objects upon the shelves were alert and quiet like little listening animals. Yvonne stood quite still there for 10 minutes, for nearly 15 minutes. She had never stood still for so long in her whole life. Then she went through into the inner room on tiptoe and began to undress in the dark. Her mother had taken up the deep center of the bed, as usual. When Yvonne put her knee upon the edge in order to get in, the whole structure groaned and rocked. Her mother woke up. "It's you, is it?" said Yvonne's mother. "I didn't hear you come in. Well, how did the evening go off? What did you do with yourselves?" "Oh, nothing special," said Yvonne. She thrust her long legs down under the clothes and reclined stiffly upon the high, cold edge of the bed. "You always say that," said her mother, "but you must have done something." "Nothing, I say," said Yvonne. "What did Sam have to show you?" "Nothing, nothing," she said. "Don't keep repeating that word at me," said her mother. "Say something else, or has the cat got your tongue?" "Did you get the Christmas cards with the roses on?" said Yvonne. "I did not," said her mother, "at 10 pence the piece. Have you anything to say at all about your evenings, or shall we go to sleep now?" "Yes," said Yvonne, "I'm going to marry Sam." "Glory be to God," said her mother. "So he got you convinced?" "He did not convince me," said Yvonne, "but I'm going to marry him now, I've decided." "You've decided, have you?" said her mother. "Well, I'm glad of it. And why, may I ask, did your majesty decide it just tonight?" "For nothing," said Yvonne. "For nothing, for nothing." She snuggled her head under the sheet and began to slide her hips down toward the center of the bed. "You make me tired," said her mother. "Can you not tell me why at all?" "No," said Yvonne. "It's a sad thing," she added. "Oh, it's a sad thing." She was silent then and would say no more. All was quiet at last in the inner room and in the shop. There would be no more trams passing now until the following day. Yvonne Geary buried her face deep in the pillow, so deep that her mother should not be able to hear that she was starting to cry. The long night was ahead. And that story was Something Special by Iris Murdoch from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Solitude by Miguel de Unamuno. Solitude was born of the death of her mother. Leopardi sang that birth is a hazard of death. Nasce l'uomo a fatica ed a rischio di morte il nascimento. Hazard with death for the newborn, hazard with death for her who gives birth. Poor Sanctuary, Solitude's mother, had led for 5 years of marriage a life of shadowed and silent tragedy. Her husband was a man impenetrable and apparently without feeling. The poor woman did not know how she had ever come to marry him. She found herself bound in matrimony with this man like somebody awakening from a dream. All her maiden life was lost in a misty distance. And when she thought of it, she remembered herself, as she had been before her marriage, as though she were remembering somebody else. Whether her husband loved her or hated her, she could not tell. His home was to him merely a place for eating and sleeping, for all the animal side of life. He worked outside of it, he talked outside of it, he amused himself outside of it. He never raised his voice or said a harsh word to his wife. He never contradicted her. When poor Sanctuary asked him a question or sought his opinion about anything, she invariably got the same reply from him. "All right, don't bother me, as you like." That persistent, "as you like," went to poor Sanctuary's sick heart like a sharp knife. "As you like," the poor woman thought to herself. "That means I'm not even worth contradicting." And then his "don't bother me," that terrible "don't bother me," which embitters so many homes. In Sanctuary's home, in what should have been Sanctuary's home, that terrible refusal not to be bothered enshadowed everything at the hearth. The first year that she was married, Sanctuary had a son, but in the dreary desolation of her drab home, she longed for a daughter. A son, she thought, a man. Men always have something to do outside their homes. So when she became pregnant, she dreamed of nothing but a daughter, and her daughter must be called Solitude. The poor woman was taken gravely ill in her pangs. Her heart fluttered feebly. She realized that she would live only long enough to give birth to her daughter, to introduce her into that shadowed home. She called for her husband. "Oh, Pedro," she said, "if it's a daughter, as I hope, you'll call her Solitude, won't you?" All right," he replied. "Time enough to think about that." And he reflected that this day of birth, he was going to miss his game of dominoes. "But I'm going to die, Pedro. I haven't the strength to get over it." "Nonsense," he replied. "It may be," Sanctuary insisted, "but if it's a daughter, you will call her Solitude, won't you?" "All right. Don't bother me. As you like," he closed the conversation. And she ceased to bother him forever. After she had given birth to her daughter, she had only time to realize that it was a daughter, and her last words were, "Solitude, remember, Pedro, Solitude." The man was shocked and would have been humbled if there had been anything of him to humble. A widower at his age and with two small children, who was going to look after his house now? Who was going to bring up his children until his daughter was old enough to be able to take over the management of it? Marry again? No, that he would not do. He knew now what marriage meant. If he had only known before, that was no solution. Very decidedly, he would not marry again. What he did was to send Solitude to a village to be reared away from home. He did not want the bother of an infant and the insolence of nurses. It was bad enough with the other child, little Peter, now 3 years old. Solitude hardly remembered those first years of her infancy at all. Her earliest dim recollection was that of dreary, drab home, and of that hermetically steeled father of hers, that man who ate at the same table with her and whom she saw for a moment when she went to bed, and of his perfunctory formal kisses. Her only companionship was that of little Peter, her brother, but Peter played with her in the strictest sense of the word. That is to say, he did not play in company with her. He played with her as one plays with a toy. She, Solitude, Solita, was his plaything, and he, like the man he was going to be, was a brute. Since his fists were stronger than hers, he always had the right of it. "You women are no good for anything. It is we men who give orders," he told her one day. Solitude was by nature acutely receptive. She had a genius for sensitiveness. Women very often have this receptive genius, but since it produces nothing, it languishes away without anybody noticing it. At first, crying and cut to the quick, Solitude used to go to that sphinx of a father of hers, expecting justice, but that unswerving man received her with his cold, all right, don't bother me, give me a kiss and see that this doesn't happen again." That, he thought, settled everything, and saved him from further annoyance. The end of it was that Solitude ceased to complain to her father about her brother's brutality, and bore everything in silence, leaving him in peace and sparing herself the humiliation of those perfunctory kisses. The dreary drabness of her home grew more and more unbearable, and the shadows that it cast grew deeper. Her only relief from it was at school, where her father had made her a day boarder, among other things, in order to get her more off his hands. At school she learnt that all her companions had, or once had, mothers. One evening at supper she dared to bother her father with the question. "Tell me, father, didn't I have a mother?" "Well, what a question," her father replied. "Of course, everybody has a mother. Why do you ask?" "Then where is my mother, papa?" "She died when you were born." "Oh, how sad." And then, just for once, her father abandoned his boorish taciturnity and told her that her mother had been called Sanctuary, and sketched for her an outline of that dead woman. "How pretty she must have been," said the child. "Yes," her father agreed. "Yes, but not as pretty as you are." This remark that he let slip went to the bottom of one of his little idiosyncrasies. If his daughter was prettier than her mother, the fact, in his opinion, was due to himself. "And what about you, Pedrine?" Solitude, excited by this fugitive stirring of the embers of the family hearth, asked her brother. "Do you remember her?" "Now how could I remember her when she died when I was only 3 years old?" "Well, if I were in your place, I should remember her," the girl replied. "Oh, of course, you women are so clever," cut in her would-be grown-up brother. "No, we're not, but I think we have longer memories." All right, stop talking nonsense and don't bother me." And so ended that memorable night when Solitude learned that she once had a mother. It gave her so much to think about that she could almost remember for herself. She peopled her solitude with maternal dreams. The years went on, all just the same, all drab and ashen beside the hearth where the fire had gone out. Her father seemed to grow no older, to possess no capacity for growing older. He did the same things at the same times every day with the regularity of a machine. But her brother began to get himself talked about until he became a byword in the town, and until he finally disappeared, whither solitude did not know. Father and daughter were left alone, alone but separated. They merely ate and slept under the same roof. At last it seemed that the day had dawned in the sky of solitude. A gallant youth, who for some time had been making eyes at her every time he saw her in the street, scraped an acquaintance with her and presented himself to her as a suitor on approval. Poor Solitude saw life beginning to open its doors to her, and despite some presentiments, which she tried in vain to scare away, she accepted him on this basis. It was like a springtide. Solitude began to live, or rather, she was really born for the first time. The meaning of many things, which up until now had had no meaning for her, was revealed to her. She began to understand much that she had heard from her mistresses and companions at school, much that she had read. Everything seemed to sing inside her. But at the same time, she realized all the emptiness of her home, and if it had not been for that picture of her betrothed that was ever present to her, she would have turned into stone there to match that man of granite, her father. For poor Solitude, this betrothal was a regular dazzling of her eyes, but her father seemed to pay no attention to it, or at least to refuse to pay any attention to it. He never made the slightest allusion to it. If he met his daughter's betrothed hanging about the railings when he left home during those blissful hours when they arranged to meet, he pretended not to see him. More than once, poor Solitude intended to say something about it to her father when they were at the supper table together, but the words stuck in her throat before she could utter them. So she said nothing and kept on saying nothing. Solitude began to read books which her betrothed gave her. Thanks to him, she began to know something of the world. This young man did not seem like other men. He was caressing, gay, unreserved, ironical, and sometimes he even contradicted her. But about her father he never said a word. It was her initiation into life, something to dream about at home. Solitude began, indeed, to glimpse what a real home might mean, homes such as those that her schoolmates had. And this knowledge, or rather this sensing, increased her horror of the backwater in which she lived. Then suddenly, one day, when she least expected it, there came a crash. Her betrothed, who had been away for a month, wrote her a long letter full of endearments, adorned with all kinds of trimmings and twistings, in which, amid all his protestations of affection, he made it clear that their relations must be regarded as at an end. He wound up with this terrible sentence. "Perhaps some day you will meet somebody who can make you happier than I could." Solitude felt an awful shudder go through her very soul. She experienced once more all the brutality, all the indescribable brutality of mankind, of men, of the male species. But she showed no sign, swallowing her humiliation and her pain in silence and with dry eyes. She would show no weakness in the presence of that sphinx of a father of hers. Why? Why had her betrothed abandoned her? Had he got tired of her? Again, why? Could a man get tired of being in love? Was it possible that he should get tired? No, the truth was that he had never loved her. Solitude, who had been thirsting for affection since the day she was born, realized that this man had never really loved her. She took refuge in herself, in remembrance of her mother, in the worship of the Virgin. She did not weep. Her pain was too deep for tears. It was a pain that burned and dried up. One night at supper, the paternal sphinx opened his mouth long enough to say, "Well, that seems to be the end of that." Solitude felt as though he had plunged a sword into her heart. She got up from the table and rushed to her own room. There, crying, "Mother, my mother," she collapsed in a spasm of agony, and thereafter the world was a waste for her. So 2 years passed, and then one morning they found her father, Don Pedro, dead in his bed. He had had a heart attack. But his daughter, now left alone in the world, did not weep for him. Solitude was left alone, quite alone. So that her solitariness should be complete, she sold the property that her father had left her, and on the proceeds of this modest fortune she went to live far away, very far away, where nobody knew her and she knew nobody. Solitude is that woman, today almost an old woman, that simple but dignified woman, whom you see every evening going to take the sun on the banks of the river, that mysterious little woman about whom nobody knows whence she came or who she is. She is that solitary benefactor who, doing good by stealth, relieves all those ills of others that she can relieve. She is that kind little woman from whom there sometimes escapes a bitter saying that betrays an affliction which she keeps to herself. Nobody knows her history, and there has grown up a legend of a terrible tragedy in her life. But as you can see for yourself, there was nothing that one could call a tragedy in her life, or at most, merely that common, that very common tragedy, undramatic, undemonstrative, which destroys so many human lives, the tragedy of solitude. It is recalled only that some years ago, solitude was sought out by a man who looked old, old before his years, bowed as though beneath the weight of vice, who a few days afterwards died in the house of that little old woman. He was my brother, that was all she said about him. And now do you understand what solitude means in the soul of a woman thirsting for tenderness and hungering for a home? A man in our society has ample scope in which to escape from solitude. But a woman, unless she chooses to shut herself up in a convent, how solitary she can be among us. That poor little woman, whom you see wandering by the river bank, without aim or object, has experienced all the weight of the brutality of the animal egotism of men. What does she think? What has she got to live for? What far-off hope keeps her going? I have gained the acquaintanceship, I cannot say the friendship, of solitude, and I have tried to glimpse her view of life and destiny, what one might call her philosophy. So far I have learned little or nothing about it. All that I have got for her is her story, which I have just told you. Apart from that, I have heard nothing from her but observations which are full of common sense, but of a common sense that seems cold and ordinary. She is a woman of extraordinary range of literary culture, for she has read very widely, and she is very far-seeing. But she remains extraordinarily susceptible to offensiveness or brutality from any quarter. She leads a solitary life, alone and retired, to avoid the rude elbowings of humanity. About us men she has a curious idea. Whenever I have succeeded in turning the conversation to the subject of men, all her answer is, "Poor little fellows!" It appears that she pities us, as though we were one of the lower order of crustaceans. But she has promised me that she will talk to me some time about men and about that great, that greatest, that supreme problem, the relationship between men and women. Not the sexual relationship, she said. Be clear about that. Not that, but the general relationship between man and woman, whether they be mother and son, brother and sister, or merely friends, on the one hand, or husband and wife, betrothed, or lovers, on the other. The important thing, the essential thing, is the general relationship, the question how a man regards a woman, whether she be his mother, his daughter, his sister, his wife, or his mistress, and how a woman regards a man, whether he be her father, her son, her brother, her husband, or her lover. I am still awaiting the day when solitude will talk to me about this. Once I was talking to her about the flood of erotic books with which we are overwhelmed today. For one can talk to solitude about anything, as long as one is careful not to hurt her. When I turned the conversation in this direction, she looked at me quizzically out of those big, bright eyes of hers, those perpetually virginal eyes, and with a shadow of a smile on her lips, she asked me, "Tell me, you eat, don't you?" "Well, of course I eat," I replied, surprised at her question. "Very well, if I caught you, a man who eats, reading a cookery book, and I had my way, I would send you to the kitchen to scour frying pans." And that was all she would say. And that story was Solitude by Miguel de Unamuno from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Blind Girls by Jane Ann Phillips. She knew it was only boys in the field come to watch them drunk on first wine. A radio in the little shack poured out promises of black love and lips. Jessie watched Sally paint her hair with grenadine, dotting the sticky syrup on her arms. The party was in a shack down the hill from her house, beside a field of tall grass where black snakes lay like flat belts. The Ripple bottles were empty, and Jesse told pornographic stories about various adults while everyone laughed, about Miss Hicks, the home ec teacher, whose hands were dimpled and moist and always touching them. It got darker and the stories got scarier. Finally, she told their favorite, the one about the girl and her boyfriend parked in a country road on a night like this, with the wind blowing and then rain, the whole sky sobbing potato juice. "Please, let's leave," pleads Girlie. "It sounds like something scratching at the car." "For God's sake," grumbles boyfriend, and takes off squealing. At home, they find the hook of a crazed amputee caught in the door. Jesse described his yellow face, putrid, and his blotchy stump. She described him panting in the grass, crying and looking for something. She could feel him smelling of raw vegetables, a rejected bleeding cowboy with wheat hair, and she was unfocused, moaning in the dark and falsetto voices. "Don't, don't, please don't." Nervous laughter. Sally looked out the window of the shack. "The grass is moving," she said. "Something's crawling in it." "No, it's nothing." "Yes, there's something coming," and her voice went up at the end. "It's just boys trying to scare us." But Sally whined and flailed her arms. On her knees, she hugged Jesse's legs and mumbled into her thighs. "It's all right. I'll take you up to the house." Sally was stiff, her nails digging the skin. She wouldn't move. Jesse tied a scarf around her eyes and led her like a horse through fire up the hill to the house, one poison light soft in a window. Boys ran out of the field, squalling. And that story was Blind Girls by Jane Ann Phillips, from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas.
That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.